Peter Frampton will be at the Times Union Center in Albany on Friday, the 3rd of June, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Peter Frampton to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great thrill and pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
Give us a sense of where you are. You've come out with a great acoustic album, and now you are out on the road. How much do you want to draw on that? How much do you want to do with a full band? How is that working out on this particular tour?
Basically, the summer tours that I do are with the band, and we're doing dates on our own, which is the full sort of 2.5 hour show, which does include a 20-minute acoustic section, which sort of is allied to obviously acoustic classics being out there. And then we're doing also co-headlining with Lynyrd Skynyrd in various places, and then we're co-headlining with Greg Allman in various places. So it's a busy summer. As far as the acoustic classics CD goes, I've been doing what I call the Raw tours. I started last year in October, and then I did a dozen dates purely acoustically. And then we did the same thing again in March. And now it's the full band tour. And then we will, in October again, we're going to do Raw 3, which will be another just all acoustic. So I'm enjoying doing both things. And I'd never done a totally acoustic show before. So, and it's just as enjoyable, but completely different, obviously, from having the whole band there. So now I'm rocking out for the summer, though.
The show that you'll be doing in Albany is with Lynyrd Skynyrd. So what is that experience like and the matching of these two musical forces?
Well, we actually go back a long way to the 70s. I used to support them, you know, as I was building up, and then Comes Alive came out in 76, and all of a sudden I was headlining everywhere. So we played a lot of very large venues together in 75, 76, and 77. So we're dear friends. I've known Gary Rossington for so long now. He's a dear friend. So when we haven't had the chance to get together for a while, so this is going to be some great gigs. And the good thing about this is you get the two longest rock songs, I think, in history. You get Free Bird and Do You Feel Like We Do in one night.
That's a great way of thinking of it. Yeah, that's two great songs, two very long songs.
Yeah, we just come on and do one song each. That's it. No, we don't.
Well, woke up this morning with a wine glass in my hand. Who's fine? What fine? Where the hell did I die? Must have been a dream.
Let us talk. I know you've talked about this a million times, but Frampton Comes Alive is still considered one of the great, if not the greatest, live album of all time. And what is it about that album that went against so much convention in the music industry and the record industry at the time that you would put out a live album and it would hit the way that album did?
In the old days, the same as the new days, but we have different technology. Word of mouth is always the best way. If I tell you to go and listen to something or buy something, you're more likely to go and listen to it and buy it than if you hear an advert or see an advert on TV. Because, you know, oh, I like what he likes, so I'm going to get that too. So now we've got social media, which has changed everything drastically. But in the old days, in the 70s, when Comes Alive came out, I had been touring incessantly since 72 in America, jumping on every show that I could, big acts, opening for huge acts all around the country. And then it seemed that my record sales were not going as well as, you know, they were building, but it was taking a while. So with Humble Pie, we'd had a great success by releasing Rock in the Fillmore, and that was Humble Pie's first hit album. But as it came out, I left and went on my solo way. So I kind of look back to Humble Pie's template of the fact that we had had the same series of four studio records that had done okay, but not great. No big hit or anything. But the live album was the one that broke through. Well, it got to the same pitch for me, starting to be in the middle spot and headlining on my own in a few places. And so we decided in 75 that we would do the same thing and do a live album. And I think it was word of mouth that I had been going around playing everywhere. And those were the first people that rushed out and bought it. All the people we'd been playing for the last 4 years, 3 or 4 years. But I think the thing that took it over the top was that there's something there's no word for, really. I hate using the word magic because it's not correct. But there's something that comes across on that album wherever you put it down, the needle down or your file, a clicker on your file these days. Wherever you start playing it, it makes you smile. And there's something that that comes out of me live that I think it's not quite there in the studio as much as it is. There's a passion and an enjoyment that me and the band were having, especially that big night in San Francisco, and it comes across. I don't know how it comes across, but it does. The band is phenomenal. It was a great one of those nights where we all came off and said, did you ever, I had, wow, oh, we all had a great night. The crowd was great, as you can hear. It was the very first time we'd headlined in San Francisco, so it was a lot of firsts there. But I think it's something that comes across. It's the passion and the enjoyment, the vibe that comes across that you can't put a word on, that sort of put it over the top.
When you think of that album and the great success, I know I've heard you say that because you went into the stratosphere then, and then there was the Rolling Stone cover, and then you become a teen idol, which I assume is not something you like really wanted.
I'd already been through that with the first band I was in that was successful in Europe, and I guess that's when I wish that I didn't look quite the way I did, but that's the way I was born. I think that if certain people advised me to do certain things, management and stuff like that, there are a lot of things that I think we could have not done, but to be honest, look at the media now. They run with it. Well, they ran with it then, but they didn't have as many outlets as we obviously do today, and it wasn't quite so instant. But I think that a lot of artists have taken their shirt off and haven't had the problems I've had with that.
You talk about that early experience in England. You were a very successful child singer. You were a member of The Herd, and then you become you're on all the covers of the teen magazines. So yes, you had experience with that, and at that time, at a young age, was it enjoyable?
Well, to start with, for about the first 3 weeks, you feel like King Kong, obviously. There's nothing like being chased by 500 screaming girls as you're trying to get away. You know, that's pretty exciting, obviously. But it wears very thin because the thing is, the reason that I got into The Herd was because I was very young. I was very good on guitar. And I didn't get hired as a singer. I got hired as the lead guitarist of the band at 16. So, again, we realized that we were being screamed at rather than being listened to. And that's when I looked elsewhere and was looking towards being in a different band that was more serious about music, playing. That's when Humble Pie, I met Steve Marriott from the Small Faces. I left the Herd and he left the Small Faces, and we formed Humble Pie, and didn't bathe, didn't shave, tried not to look good. And the first single we had in England, Natural Born Boogie, we were on TV, and then we went to our first gig and we got screamed at again. So we said, this isn't what we wanted. Let's go to America. So that's when we decided, where no one really knew us. They knew of Small Faces a little bit, never heard of the Herd. So we figured, let's go start from the bottom over there. It's better than being screamed at here. So that's what we did. And did a pretty good job of it, obviously. And then, obviously, at around the time, as I said, when Rockin' the Fillmore came out, I had reached a point where I wanted to go and front my own band.
Right.
And that's when I left.
In doing that, in fronting your own band and going solo, are there points where you think, oh, what have I done? Or do you always see it as, okay, we just have to find the right thing that will hit?
Absolutely, I said, what have I done? When I saw the album that I had helped mix and was on, Rockin' the Fillmore, zoom up the American charts and the British charts, I think everything was going swimmingly. And now I think I might have made the worst decision of my life. But I was not deterred because I had a plan and my plan just consisted of writing new music that turned me on and improving as a guitar player and doing more of that and deciding what I wanted to do all the time rather than it go to committee. So I did have moments where I thought that maybe this wasn't the right road early on, but then very soon after I started the solo career and started moving up from the opening, I went back to the opening spot again, and then in the middle spot of a three-act show. And then, you know, a couple of years after that, I start headlining. So I felt that I was making progress. And then, of course, that was up until about the Frampton album, which was the one that came out in 75, which had Show Me the Way and Baby, I Love You Way on that studio-wise.
Shadows go so long before my eyes, and they're moving across the page. Suddenly the day turns into night, far away from the city. Don't hesitate, 'cause your love
That year is when we went around and recorded the live album.
You talk about post that album and in the early 80s and into the 1980s, of what impact working with David Bowie had on your career. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, obviously you were old friends.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it so important to you and ultimately so beneficial to your career?
Well, first of all, I met David, we became friends when I was 12. So, and then who knew that we were both going to have successful musical careers? No one knew that.
Right.
At that time, obviously. He was 15. I was 12. So I've always looked up to him. He's always been a mentor to me as a friend and as a musician, you know. He was always there to, you know, I'd see him every now and again, speak on the phone and go out to dinner once in a while. And so we kept in touch. Then it wasn't until mid to late 70s when he called me up and said, look, I'm doing a new album. I really love what you're doing on your latest album, meaning mine. guitar-wise, can you come and play on my record? And that's when, obviously, I said, let me think about Yes. this is what I'd wanted. You know, we'd played on the same stage. We jammed at school. I'd never played with David, you know. So this, in Humble Pie, he was our special guest on our tour of England in 69. You know, there was a lot of history, obviously. So when he asked me to play on the Never Let Me Down record, and then subsequently go on the Glass Spider tour, he could have chosen any guitarist he wanted, and they would probably all have said yes. But he asked me. Never let me down. She never let me down. Never let me down. She never let me down. It was a great feeling that I was going to get to go on stage with David finally. And what the gift that he gave me, and I have said this before, is that my career was almost over at that point as far as the backlash from the Frampton Comes Alive, well, the Frampton Comes Alive backlash.
Right.
Too much of anything ain't good for anybody. And at that point, so he took me as the guitar player and reintroduced me as that around the world in stadiums. For that, I never stopped thanking him, and I still thank him to this day because he knew me so well, and he knew that that wasn't what I wanted, and he knew that I was the musician first and foremost, and that by some freak this had happened, this second time around with the Teeny Bopper thing. So he knew that by having me play with him, this would tar me with a different feather, which I still wear.
Of course, his passing is devastating, but do you feel that he knew and you were able to express to him what that meant to you?
Oh, many times.
That's
yes.
Great.
He knew that I was incredibly thankful and grateful, and I know that. So, yes, my father was his art teacher and friend. They had a great relationship, and he knew my children, and so, you know, my mother and everybody. So it was kind of like he was part of the family in a way, always. Whenever Dad would come and when he came to see us rehearse for, no, doing a press conference, that's right, when we played in London to announce the Glass Spider tour, Mum and Dad came, obviously, and as soon as they came backstage, big hug from David, and next thing I know, where's Dave? Where's Dad? They disappeared. That was it. They were catching up somewhere. So it was one of those sort of family kind of relationships.
Peter Frampton will be performing with Lynyrd Skynyrd on June 3rd at the Times Union Center in Albany, New York. And how does the show work? You're on first, they're on first. How's that work?
who's on first? No, we are going to go on first, and they will be on after us.
And you have a great time. Do you ever get to work together?
We'll have to see about that. I don't know. Can you do a mashup of Do You Feel in Freebird? That would be interesting.
Give it a shot. You got the whole summer to figure it out. Give it a shot.
Absolutely.
It's Lynyrd Skynyrd and Peter Frampton at the Times Union Center on June 3rd. Peter Frampton, what a thrill to talk to you. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks, Joe. Always a pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Peter Frampton with Lynyrd Skynyrd at the Times Union Center on June 3rd. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.